requires to have a job at an adequate wage with proper benefits. And it not only gives that worker a direct job, those workers that aren't in the public sector, they would be able to better bargain where they are for better wages, et cetera. And I'll give one quick example. I know we're running short on time. If you are a waitress putting up with sexual harassment at your job, or a black man or black woman being discriminated in your job, you have less agency to deal with that if you don't have an alternative. And what building up the public sector employment can do is provide that alternative, and then also provide it in a way that's building our public infrastructure that goes directly to the public in areas that frankly, the private sector is not adequately producing, such as making our environment more resilient.
On that note, I want to thank you for being with us. Derek Hamilton, professor of economics at the New School, founding director of its Institute on Race and Political Economy. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. You can learn more and apply today at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warren, Arturina Nadura Hamalkoff, Maria, Studio John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Governor Kate Brown moves up Oregon's vaccine timeline so that all Oregonians over the age of 16 will be eligible on April 19th. The murder trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin continues today with testimony from other Minneapolis officers. And a federal labor board finds Amazon illegally retaliated against two workers when they were fired after speaking out. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 6th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority reported 248 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 167,128. Oregon health officials also reported two new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,394 people. There are currently 177 people hospitalized statewide, including 42 patients in intensive care units. Governor Kate Brown announced Tuesday that both Multnomah and Clackamas counties would return to the high-risk COVID classification level starting Friday, April 9th. The move comes as case counts and hospitalizations have increased throughout several parts of the state. The counties will remain in the high-risk category for the next 2 weeks. So far, at least 2 million first and second doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon. On Monday, frontline workers became eligible, along with people 16 and older with underlying health conditions and those living in multi-generational households. Governor Brown said Tuesday morning that Oregon is moving up their vaccine timeline once again. Starting April 19th, all Oregonians over the age of 16 will be eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. The change comes as President Joe Biden is planning to announce that every adult in the U.S. will be eligible for a vaccine by that date. Biden has stressed that while the U.S. is now vaccinating a record number of Americans, the battle against COVID-19 is far from over, as cases are once again on the rise. The president has called on governors and local leaders to maintain, and in some cases reinstate, mask mandates. This comes as states have lifted their mask requirements and allowed businesses to return to full capacity against the guidance from public health experts. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 30.8 million cases of COVID-19. At least 555,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 65,000 new cases per day, an increase of 20% from the average 2 weeks earlier. So far, about 32% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 19% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 131.8 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.8 million people have died across the world. Lawyers for the U.S. Department of Justice have issued the City of Portland a formal notice of noncompliance with its settlement agreement over excessive use of force by police. DOJ attorneys also found that Portland's current police oversight board is relying on flawed, if not unconstitutional, logic to clear Portland cops of alleged misconduct. This is especially true in cases where officers used force against members of the public during 2020's racial justice protests. In short, the DOJ believes Portland officers have been wrongly cleared in cases where they used inappropriate force against a member of the public. This offers a rare peek behind the curtain of the city's most consequential police oversight board, one that Portlanders voted to replace last November. However, the new oversight board is still years away. Last month, federal lawyers said they had asked Portland police to create a plan on how they will properly report, analyze, and investigate officers' use of force. But the city argues a correction plan is not required under the settlement. In February, the Justice Department found the Portland Police Bureau failed to meet four key reforms under the settlement, citing inappropriate police use and management of force during protests, inadequate training, subpar police oversight, and failure to adequately share an annual police bureau report with the public. The settlement followed a federal investigation that found Portland officers used excessive force against people experiencing mental health issues. It called for widespread changes to use of force and taser policies, training, supervision, and oversight, a restructuring of police crisis intervention services, and quicker police misconduct investigations. The city now has 30 days to respond in writing to the Justice Department's notice that it is not in compliance with the settlement. A face-to-face meeting would then be held to try to bridge the stalemate. At least three such meetings have already occurred with no resolution, so it is likely the parties will next head to mediation. If the problems still are not resolved, the case will go back before a federal judge. The murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin continues this week with more testimony. Chauvin is accused of killing George Floyd in May of 2020 after kneeling on his neck for almost 10 minutes. The Minneapolis chief of police, Madaria Arredondo, testified Monday afternoon that Chauvin's actions and use of force were contrary to department policy. In particular, the chief said Chauvin's kneeling on Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds was a violation of the policies around de-escalation, objectively reasonable use of force, and requirement to render aid. Georgia Fort has more on the story with the Racial Reckoning Project.
The Minneapolis Chief of Police Madaira Arredondo testified Monday afternoon denouncing the actions of former police officer Derek Chauvin.
That is not part of our policy. That is not what we teach. And that should be condoned.
Arredondo's the first African-American to serve as chief of the Minneapolis Police Department. He was appointed to the position following the abrupt resignation of the previous chief, who stepped down after Officer Muhammad Noor shot and killed a white woman in 2017. During Chief Arredondo's testimony, he went on to share how Chauvin's actions did not align with MPD's ethics.
Did you see the defendant or any of the officers attempt to provide first aid to Mr. Floyd?
I did not see any of the defendants attempt to provide first aid to Mr. Floyd. The defendant violated our policy in terms of rendering aid.
Arredondo also stated that in most situations, a counterfeit $20 bill is not an arrestable offense. The chief was released from the stand after nearly 4 hours of testimony. He was followed by Commander Kate Blackwell, who was in charge of training at MPD.
Is this a trained technique by the Minneapolis Police Department when you were overseeing the training unit?
It is not.
And why not?
What we train is using one arm or two arm to do a neck restraint.
And how does this differ?
I don't know what kind of improvised position that is.
George Floyd's brothers were both in the courtroom Monday, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. Meanwhile, the chair set aside for Derek Chauvin's family has been removed due to lack of use. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
The Chauvin murder trial continued Tuesday with testimony from two Minneapolis police officers. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
The trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd in May of last year continues today with testimony from two Minneapolis police officers focusing on use of force training. Police Lieutenant Johnny Mercel, a use of force trainer for the department, testified this morning, saying that Chauvin's actions were not consistent with how officers are trained to restrain someone resisting arrest. He added that officers are told to stay away from the neck when restraining a suspect, and if using body weight in order to control the suspect, to put the weight on the shoulder and be mindful of position. Mercel also testified that officers are trained to stand or sit a suspect up or put them on their side in a so-called recovery position once handcuffed and complacent. When asked how soon a person should be put in such a position, he replied, quote, I would say the sooner the better. Also testifying today is Minneapolis Police Sergeant Kerry Yang, who serves as the department's crisis intervention training coordinator. Under cross-examination by the defense, Yang was asked what signs of aggression police officers are trained to watch for. Yang answered that these signs could be things such as a raised voice, rapid breathing, muscle tension, agitation, and pacing. He also added that officers are trained to observe bystanders and how to evaluate the entire situation beyond the suspect they are trying to arrest. Yang testified that officers are trained in a critical decision-making model to address people in crisis, which includes review and reassess, saying, quote, we assess the situation to see if our technique on the de-escalation or other technique is working. If it's not working, then we readjust our technique and our strategies, noting that actions can be readjusted at this point. Yang, when asked about a suspect needing medical attention, replied that such attention would be an immediate goal. Today's testimony comes a day after Minneapolis Police Chief Madera Arredondo testified that Chauvin's use of force against George Floyd was absolutely in violation of department policy. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
The National Labor Relations Board has determined that Amazon illegally retaliated against two workers when the company fired them last year. The employees, Emily Cunningham and Marin Costa, had publicly pushed the company to reduce its impact on climate change and address concerns about its warehouse workers. Agency staff said it would accuse Amazon of unfair labor practices if the company did not settle the case. The case would then go before an administrative law judge. The two women were among dozens of Amazon workers who have told the labor board about company retaliations in the last year. But in most other cases, the workers had complained about pandemic safety. Claims of unfair labor practices at Amazon have been so common that the labor agency is considering turning them into a national investigation. The focus on Amazon's labor practices has escalated in the past year as online orders have surged during the pandemic, and the company expanded its U.S. workforce to almost 1 million people. This week, the National Labor Board is counting ballots that will determine whether almost 6,000 workers will unionize at an Amazon warehouse outside Birmingham, Alabama. So far, this is the largest and most viable labor threat in the company's history. The union has said the workers face excessive pressure to produce and are intensely monitored to make sure quotas are met. The union election voting ended on March 29th, and the public portion of the count is expected to begin as soon as Wednesday. The sheer size of the bargaining unit, combined with the fact that votes were submitted via mail, has meant that the election process has taken longer than usual. To win, the union needs just a simple majority of the votes cast at the warehouse. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and today is a National Day of Action. KBOO's Al Kahn has more.
April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and today, the first Tuesday of the month, is recognized as a day of action. Each year during the month of April, state, territory, tribal, and community-based organizations, rape crisis centers, government agencies, businesses, campuses, and individuals plan events and activities to highlight sexual violence as a public health, human rights, and social justice issue, and reinforce need for prevention efforts. The goals of this day of action are to raise awareness of sexual assault, harassment, and abuse, and attempt to stop it before it occurs through education. During the 70s, there was a growth in awareness of sexual assault and harassment across the country, seeing the nation's first rape crisis center open in San Francisco in 1971, and the forming of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape in 1975. In 1976, the first Take Back the Night marches began across the country, organizing protests against rape and sexual violence as women marched against the fear felt on the streets after dark. Then in 1994, Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, which was the first national law requiring law enforcement to treat gender violence as a crime rather than a private matter and establish legal protections for survivors and their children. Although teaching about such things as consent and boundaries is an important step, society also needs to change their perspective on sexual assault and abuse, shifting the blame from the victim to the abuser. Until this happens, a great proportion of sexual assault will continue to go unpunished. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the dangers of romance scams. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 55 degrees. Today in history, in 1896, the Olympic Games, a long-lost tradition of ancient Greece, are reborn in Athens 1,500 years after being banned by a Roman emperor. The first modern-day Olympics welcomed athletes from 13 countries to the international competition. The 2020 Olympics, which were pushed to 2021 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, will see 205 countries compete in Tokyo, Japan. The quote of the day is from women's and civil rights activist Dorothy Height, who said, quote, "Civil rights are civil rights. There are no persons who are not entitled to their civil rights. We have to recognize that we have a long way to go, but we have to go that way together." Community colleges across the country are scrambling to bring back students who dropped out or never enrolled during the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly focusing on students of color. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Community colleges nationwide are bracing for another drop in enrollment this year, especially among students of color. Data from the National College Attainment Network shows only about 55% of high school seniors have applied for federal financial aid. And the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center reports that in 2020, first-time enrollment was down 13% overall and almost 20% among Latino students. Paul Feast with the California Community College's Chancellor's Office says the pandemic has severely disrupted potential students' lives.
Many of our students are facing challenges with losing their jobs, having lower wages, having to care for their children, you know, as they're being homeschooled.
Feast says in California, fall community college enrollment dropped by 11% overall from 2019 to 2020, but 12% for Latino students, 16% for African Americans, and a whopping 22% for Native American students. And he says schools lost twice as many men compared with women. The most recent stimulus package includes millions for colleges to re-engage the student population. Feast adds that a chunk of money is targeted for direct aid to students.
And there's also some funding available for emergency grants for students that can help pay for things like childcare, transportation, technology assistance.
Colleges are hoping that the dip in enrollment is temporary and will rebound as the economy recovers from COVID. Students can find a wealth of information on financial aid and other programs at stayenrolled.com and icanaffordcollege.com. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
In response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the federal government has temporarily expanded college students' access to SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. During the pandemic, everyone who qualifies for SNAP also will receive the maximum benefit amount for their household size. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Thousands of low-income college students in Colorado now have an easier path to food assistance during the pandemic after the federal government issued temporary changes to its qualification policies for SNAP, the program previously known as food stamps. All students who qualify will also receive the maximum amount for their household size. Benu Amun-Ra is a Naropa University student who cares for her child and mother. She says SNAP has been a game changer.
It has changed my diet. What I can afford now allows me to go to local grocery stores to purchase fresh produce and fruits and vegetables.
Students with an expected family contribution of zero based on federal financial aid calculations and those eligible for work study, even if they don't currently have a job, may be eligible for $234 per month or more in food benefits. A family of four can receive $782 to buy food. A new online guide offers information on navigating the enrollment process at hungerfreecolorado.org. Students can apply for SNAP at colorado.gov/PEAK. Terry Chaston with the Colorado Department of Human Services says even before COVID, there was a common misperception that college students are not eligible for SNAP. But she says many low-income students do qualify for food assistance, and with the new criteria, benefits are now available to thousands more.
With COVID, we know that many of our students who are working part-time or in the service industry may have lost their employment and are having a harder time meeting their needs, especially around buying food for themselves.
Some grocery stores and farmers markets will match SNAP benefits dollar for dollar up to $20 per day when purchasing fruits, vegetables, and other items. The new temporary exemptions for SNAP participation will be in effect until 30 days after the COVID-19 public health emergency has been officially lifted. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
Infrastructure becomes the latest political football, Janet Yellen talks global corporate taxes, and Mitch McConnell warns CEOs to stay out of politics. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
It is great to be in Oakland and to be home.
Vice President Kamala Harris was back on her old turf of California Monday to promote the American Jobs Plan, which includes $111 billion for water infrastructure.
We must understand how precious this resource is. We must understand the equities and inequities of distribution and access to clean water, especially clean drinking water.
Republicans argue the $2 trillion plan is too broad. Others believe it's not enough. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey called for Biden to go bigger.
Our country needs a roadmap for recovery that addresses the intersecting crises that we face as a nation and a planet. The climate crisis, a public health pandemic, racial injustice, and economic inequality.
The White House wants to fund the proposal through corporate tax code changes and other measures to discourage overseas investments. Democrat West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin said he'll support raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 25%, not the 28% Biden proposes. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen wants other nations to join the U.S. in imposing a global corporate tax minimum.
The United States needs to have a strong presence in global markets on a level playing field.
Yellen argued the taxation of multinational corporations spurs innovation, growth, and prosperity. In a protest over Major League Baseball's stance on Georgia's new voting law, Texas Governor Greg Abbott declined an invitation to throw the first pitch at the Texas Rangers home opener. Abbott said MLB's decision to pull the All-Star game from Atlanta was based on a false narrative about election reforms. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell also weighed in on the controversy by warning CEOs to stay out of politics. Speaking in Kentucky, he called corporations protesting the law bullies. McConnell also encouraged people to get the COVID-19 vaccine, noting stories he's heard of hesitancy among Republican men.
These reservations need to be put aside, because the only way I think we get to finally put this pandemic in the rearview mirror is with herd immunity.
The White House later thanked McConnell on Twitter for taking leadership in the vaccine rollout. A federal appeals panel vacated a Trump administration rule that would have prevented the EPA from setting greenhouse gas limits on sectors whose pollution accounts for more than 3% of the country's total emissions. The oil and gas industry would likely have been exempt. And with the traditional Easter egg roll canceled for a second year due to the pandemic, President Joe Biden spoke from a White House balcony Monday alongside the First Lady and a masked Easter bunny. Biden said, in celebrating the renewal of the season, a longed-for dawn nears.
We will rebuild our nation. We will re-engage and reimagine what we can be.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
A jury convicts the chair of a Montana Native nonprofit of theft, and Secretary Holland will meet with New Mexico tribal leaders. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal jury has convicted the former chairwoman of a Montana nonprofit of false claims, wire fraud, and theft from a program receiving federal funding. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas has more.
Meredith McConnell is the most recent former staff member and leader within the Montana Native Women's Coalition to be convicted of misusing federal grant funds to benefit herself and others. The coalition's former executive director, Cheryl Lawrence, and ex-board member, Barbara Daychief, pleaded guilty to stealing funding from the coalition earlier this year. The Montana Native Women's Coalition seeks to support Native American victims of sexual and domestic abuse. The Montana U.S. Attorney's Office argued that over a four-month period in 2017, McConnell was responsible for the mishandling of more than 10% of the nonprofit's grant funds. McConnell pleaded not guilty to all charges, claiming her signature was forged on a number of incriminating documents. Following the federal jury's conviction, McConnell faces a maximum of 20 years in prison, a $250,000 fine, and 3 years of supervised release. She has not yet been sentenced. For National Native News, reporting from Montana, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
Native women's advocates are praising Interior Secretary Deb Haaland's creation of a new unit to put renewed focus on cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Mark Richardson reports.
Under the Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Justice Services, the Missing and Murdered Unit will coordinate across departments and agencies to pursue thousands of unresolved cases. A majority involve Indigenous women, and Angel Charlie, with the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women, says the move spotlights an issue that's been on the back burner for too long.
We're happy to see that Secretary Holland is addressing it on the infrastructure level, and then organizations like ours continue to do that grassroots organizing, supporting community and family.
The unit will support existing efforts and add a unit chief responsible for stakeholder collaboration and policy development. It also funds new investigators, data analysts, and victim services coordinators. Charlie predicts the effort will be a major help to her organization.
It's going to take a bunch of people working on different levels to continue to address the issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women.
Charlie adds that in her view, President Joe Biden's move to name an American Indian as Interior Secretary is already paying dividends.
This is why representation matters.
I'm Mark Richardson.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland is meeting with tribal leaders in New Mexico Tuesday. She's hosting a listening session with the All Pueblo Council of Governors in Albuquerque. Haaland will hear about how the pandemic has impacted tribal communities, and she'll talk about President Biden's American Rescue Plan. It's touted as the largest single investment in Indian country, with $31.2 billion in tribal communities. And a new jobs plan includes support for tribes to address broadband, infrastructure, and economic development. Meanwhile, tribal leaders in New Mexico joined the state's governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, in Santa Fe Monday for the signing of House Bill 6 into law. The bill ends credits for impact aid payments in the public school funding formula, providing schools with federally impacted land access to more than $600 million. Leaders say the practice had disadvantaged Native students and communities. School districts will now be able to use 100% of their impact aid funds. Tribes in the state have advocated for the change for years, especially for school districts with high Native student populations to receive full impact aid benefits. Tribal leaders also say consultation is an important part of the impact aid application process. Federal impact aid is designed to assist local school districts that miss out on property tax revenue due to the presence of tax-exempt federal properties in their district. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
One library in Wisconsin offers programs to engage a diverse group of people in local climate planning and to improve climate literacy. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Libraries do more than loan books. They also help build community and advance literacy.
Information literacy is something of a crisis in our country, and there's maybe nowhere where we see this more clearly than around climate literacy.
That's Nick Dembski of the Racine Public Library in Wisconsin. It's one of 25 libraries with funding from the American Library Association to offer programming about climate change. Dembski says Racine has a diverse community, but that diversity is not well reflected in local climate action.
So we wanted to put some events to particularly highlight that, interrogate that, and maybe see if we can shift that in the long run.
The library co-hosted a screening and discussion of the film Fire and Flood. It focuses on the resilience of queer communities and queer people of color during climate disasters. The library also hosted events with the mayor's office to engage people in climate action planning. One was held in Spanish to prioritize Latino input. The other highlighted the voices of the Black community.
We need everyone at the table, not just in this community, but in every community around the globe.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 6, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Georgia Fort, Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. Then at 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO's currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name?
Hello.
year into the pandemic, it would be hard to say that the feeling of loneliness hasn't entered each of our lives in some way. But it's not always that it takes a financial toll, too. From 2019 to 2020, the reported losses from sweetheart or romance scams increased by 50%, according to the Federal Trade Commission. Over $300 million were lost to these kinds of scams last year. AARP Oregon is hosting a webinar to educate people about the warning signs of romance scams on April 23rd. I spoke with Chuck Harwood, the FTC Regional Director, to learn more.
So I understand AARP Oregon is hosting a series of virtual programs, and one of them is focused on romance or sweetheart scams. So to start out, what is a romance scam?
Sure. Well, that's so a romance scam is basically a scheme or a tactic in which scammers try to befriend somebody, usually online, to convince them that to send them money, or typically money, but sometimes they also ask them to do other things for them, and they do that simply by making the victim believe that they have met someone who is either going to become a close friend or potentially even develop a romance with. They're going to even develop a romance with. You know, we've had the pandemic, and obviously it's tragic in many ways. But another in the long list of, you know, the real consequences that we've all felt through the pandemic has been the, you know, just the basic loneliness and isolation that was brought on by living virtually pretty much all the time. And that might explain why romance scams have reached literally a record number in 2020. We estimated about based on reports just to the FTC, there were $304 million in reported losses just in 2020, and that's about a 50% increase from 2019. So a huge growth in the numbers. And those numbers have gone up year after year for a number of years, but particularly in 2020, we saw a huge increase. Oftentimes, as I think I alluded to, romance scammers create fake profiles. They may do it on dating apps or social media, and they make up stories about, you know, that will hopefully attract somebody to them. Sometimes it begins with a friend request in social media. Sometimes it's some kind of a dating app where there's an attractive person depicted, something like that. But invariably at some point they always need money, and they will ask for money at some point. And usually they work the victim long enough that the victim doesn't realize that they've been hooked, or doesn't necessarily just say no. Instead, they oftentimes end up sending the money, which is where you end up with these really substantial losses. By far, the largest loss of any individual type of scam that we've seen.
What does that look like numbers-wise? Does it stack up differently than other scams?
Yeah, it's much higher. And it's much higher on individual scams. It's also much higher for losses. So, for example, I can look at a couple of different ways. But first of all, the number of people who were enticed in these romance scams who were between 20 and 29 years old actually doubled between 2019 and 2020. The amount of money lost by each individual who's a victim of these scams is an average of $2,500. It can be much larger for some people than others, but it's about $2,500, and that's 10 times the median loss of other scams or frauds. So 10 times the typical loss we'd see for other frauds. And a couple of other interesting facts that in terms of the age of people who fall for it, I mentioned that we saw the biggest growth between 20 and 29 year olds, but people 40 to 69 continue to be the ones who most likely report losing money. And for consumers over 70, they reported average losses of almost $10,000 per person.
Wow. So what are some of the warning signs that, you know, you might be experiencing a romance scam? How do you get guarded against that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, so lots of times it'll begin with some kind of a friend request or a something online, you know, begins fairly, it seems pretty innocuous, either in social media or on a dating app site. But the person will usually pretty early on try to isolate the person they're trying to victimize in a way, try to get them to be cut off from other people, their friends, their neighbors, because they really don't want the person that they're trying to get the money from to actually talk to other people and get a reality check, if you will. And so oftentimes they'll try to separate them, may try to take them off of the dating app and have them correspond with them separately. They'll almost always ask for money. Usually when they ask for money, they'll oftentimes have a complicated story about why they're asking. They'll have, for example, they're facing a hardship, or they may actually offer to send the target or the victim money before they actually ask for money. And sometimes they will actually send money, but then they'll suddenly say, well, I need it back again, or I need it to be sent to a third party. And what's happening there is they may be engaging in money laundering to move the money around. There's another whole story about the other crimes are associated with this problem. They'll urge them not to talk to other people. They'll oftentimes promise to come meet their victim, but then for various reasons, they suddenly can't make it. Suddenly something came up and they can't make it. The perpetrator will oftentimes, there are some categories we see a lot. For example, oftentimes claim to be living overseas, or they claim to be in the military. In fact, I can give you a couple of examples just that I pulled off of our recent last month examples of these kinds of schemes, if you'd like to hear about them. But they'll claim military or something like that, but yet they never actually carry through on their promises to come visit.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear about some of those examples.
Sure. So this is one just from last month, March. And this is, this person said that the person who was scamming them claimed to be in the military, friended them on Facebook, started with, sweet words, building up to an online romance. And then they sprang some money problems on them. They needed money to go home, which really isn't true in the military, but they created a story about that. There are several other areas they needed money. The person claimed he was in the army, had been in the Middle East for 2 years, needed money to buy food because he didn't like the food that he was being offered in the army. So wanted to go somewhere else and buy it, but didn't have that money. He wanted to be paid using a variety of schemes such as MoneyGrams or Bitcoin. He just kept asking more money. Very polite the whole time. Took a lot of interest in the consumer, in the victim's life. Also claimed his account's been frozen, which is every need of money. So they created a variety. He created a variety of, scenarios why he needed the money desperately, and he enticed the consumer to give him money. And the other thing that we saw happen, this particular victim described, was the longer the consumer is victimized, the less likely it is they believe they're really a victim. They have a hard time separating themselves from these scammers once they get hooked. And it's tragic when you talk to somebody who's been the victim. They oftentimes still think that the perpetrator, may actually not have been lying to them, may actually be out there someplace looking for them. So for example, this consumer describes how her daughter tried to talk her out of it, begging her not to listen to this scammer who claimed he was military. And begging her to ignore it and step aside, and yet she continued to send money for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So question for you, if someone's hearing this and it sets off some kind of inkling in their head, what advice would you give to someone who suspects they might be in the beginning stages of a romance scam? Are there kind of questions that you should be asking?
So this is a good time, particularly when we're not seeing our friends, neighbors as much, and you have to rely on phone and video to communicate more. It really is a good time to be asking about what people are doing. Take some maybe slightly nosy interest in, but take some interest in their love interests that they have, or the new friends they've met online. And particularly ask them about, what kind of relationship they developed. If they mention that they're asking for money, it's critical to be as firm as possible that a request for money from somebody that you've only met online and don't know is more likely than not going to be a scam. And you have to be extraordinarily forceful and communicate with that individual yourself, but also arrange with their friends and neighbors to communicate. because over and over again we hear that people cannot be dissuaded from, you know, from these kinds of scams easily. So it really takes a team effort to try to dissuade them if you think they've been hooked. And you really need to work at it to convince them not to. One more thing, you really need to cut them off from the scammer, because as long as the scammer can reach them, they will continue to try. So if you can get them to change email accounts, change, you know, however they're communicating with the scammer, and stop using that mechanism, that means they're going to be better off.
I was going to ask about, like, are there specific warnings that one might take from the method by which they're requesting money? You mentioned Bitcoin. I know Western Union has been a scam hotspot, you could say.
Yeah, well, yeah, we saw they oftentimes will ask for it through some means like wire transfers. But this, in the past year, we saw a lot of times which they were asking actually for money to be sent using, you know, prepaid gift cards, you know, the Apple iPhones or iTunes cards or things like that, or other kinds of gift cards. And they either wanted the cards mailed or to have the PIN number provided to them. And that seems to have been, it was a growing mechanism or method that we saw just in the last year or so being used. So you want to watch for that as well. But you know, the truth is, any way they can get the money, particularly if it's untraceable, that's what they want to do.
When you are talking to people about romance scams and trying to warn against them, do you encounter misconceptions that people have about how it plays out?
I do, yeah. So there are a couple things. People always assume that victims of romance scams are, you know, little old men and ladies living by themselves in their homes. And, you know, they assume that a, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 year old wouldn't be a victim of this kind of thing. In fact, that's not true. As I've mentioned, the growth in scams, in this kind of scam targeting younger people, has been greater than it has been among older consumers. And secondly, you know, the people who lose the most money are people in their middle age years, not old people. So it's important to not think about just as, someone who's in their 60s or 70s, although certainly those people lose the most money, but you shouldn't just assume they're the only ones who lose money.
And what is the FTC's role in monitoring these kinds of scams? Is there mitigation? Is this like the main mitigation effort in informing people, yeah, or are there other aspects, yeah, that the FTC addresses?
Sure. Well, that's a great question too. So the tragic part of these scams, aside from the effect, the emotional impact and the financial impact it has on consumers who are victims, and it can be, as I said, it can last for a long time, is it's very hard to catch the people who perpetrate these things. Lots of times they're overseas. We hear a lot of times where the perpetrator of the scheme is, you know, in Africa someplace or in Asia, which makes it nearly impossible for a law enforcement agency to catch up with. Occasionally they're enticed to the United States, but it's rare that happens. So for most law enforcement agencies, this is a very frustrating crime to deal with, because your chances of catching the perpetrator are high. The FTC's role is twofold. First, we do take complaints, and we would welcome complaints from consumers who believe they or their friends have been victimized by this. We use to track and develop information, such as information I've been using today, talk about how people have been victimized and what to watch out for. You can report to reportfraud.ftc.gov with this information. Secondly, we will refer the complaints to other law enforcement agencies who have the kinds of capabilities that might allow them to get people back from overseas. The FTC is a civil law enforcement agency, so we don't have the same powers as a criminal law enforcement agency might, but we'll certainly try to refer the complaints. And then secondly, or third, I guess, we work on education, the kind of education you're hearing about here, and try to alert both people who may be victimized, and frankly, honestly, this kind of scam, or their friends, be on lookout for it, watch for it, be aware that someone of almost any age could fall for this kind of really tragic scheme.
Chuck, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
Yeah, let me offer one more thought, or maybe two more thoughts. First thought is that these scammers, another bad aspect of this, is oftentimes trying to entice their victims into helping them commit other crimes. So, for example, we saw a lot of instances recently where of unemployment benefits were being stolen from states. Oregon, I think, had this problem, among others. What was happening was people were applying the names of other people for unemployment checks. And in many cases, the people who were victims of romance scams were being used to help funnel that money overseas. People would say, I'll have some money sent to you, and then you forward it on to me. And the people who got the money were unwittingly acting as helping money launder the money that was being sent overseas. So that's my first thought. Second thought, don't go by what somebody looks like on the computer. I mean, it's very easy to create a fake persona, fake picture, everything else. I know I was talking to the Attorney General from Montana a couple years ago, and he had discovered his name, his face was being used by romance scammers. And he's, you know, he's a typical looking 50-year-old guy who had just discovered that his face was being used over and over again. So people think they're being victimized. It's a good idea to do an image search. You know, if you've got a picture of the person who's victimizing you, do an image search on Google or whatever your favorite browser is and see if other pictures come up just like that. That's a great strategy. Or if you can't, you know, a friend can do it. The final thing I'll say is, if somebody tells you they've stopped being a victim, believe them, but keep checking, because this really is the kind of scheme where people get hooked. I remember talking to people, you know, literally months, if not years later, in small towns, who said they still think that out there someplace their true love may still be waiting for them, even though they know, you know, their brain is telling them they were victimized. Their heart though tells them otherwise. So they really need to stay in touch with folks if it appears they've been victimized.
That was my conversation with Chuck Harwood, the FTC regional director, about the alarming uptick in romance scams over the course of the pandemic and the warning signs to watch out for. AARP Oregon is hosting a webinar to educate people about the topic on April 23rd. Find links related to this story online at kbu.fm. For KBU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had said, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
So, welcome to COVID Noise Filter. My name is Dr. Mark Alderi, and we are so happy to have guest co-hosting with us, Nurse Julia. Welcome to the show, Nurse Julia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be coming on board with you guys.
Thank you so much, and now on to the show.
The U.S. and other wealthy nations are making it harder for the globe to get vaccines.
Oh, goodness gracious.
In June, the World Health Organization came up with a plan called COVAX, which would allow countries to pool resources and market power to get better prices on vaccines. This plan, in addition to mitigating the first gamble of vaccine development, ensured equity in global distribution of the vaccine, as there was a list of participating countries that would coordinate.
That's right. And to be clear, COVAX, of course, stands for coronavirus vaccine. And we've reported on that multiple times because we do follow that COVAX story. Because remember, where there's coronavirus in even the most remote parts of the world means that there's coronavirus everywhere. So we do need to prioritize the whole globe getting vaccinated. But when vaccine trials did produce positive results, it should come as no shock that richer countries such as the United States began to focus on the pharmaceutical companies themselves for distribution instead. And according to Slate, $7 billion of the $8.2 billion purchased vaccine doses and they were bought without COVAX being part of the process. Now, naturally, this greatly disadvantaged poorer countries as vaccines are still relatively scarce. And the United States bought more than COVAX's total purchase of 1.1 billion doses, making up 15% of the total global purchases.
Wow. In addition to increasing scarcity, departure from COVAX weakened the group's market power. Pharmaceutical companies have no incentive to sell COVAX when they can make larger direct deals with richer nations. In February, the U.S. donated $4 billion to COVAX and made a call for other nations to follow suit. Wealthy nations dealing with pharmaceutical companies also blocks access to the intellectual property of the vaccines. And because they were developed by private companies, the vaccine is their intellectual property.
But also, let's be clear, the vaccine actually was initially developed by the U.S. government. So taxpayer dollars. I just want to make sure we're clear about that. All right. While some argue that this increases innovation in the industry, it also prevents generic vaccines. Generics could increase supply and make the vaccine more widely available, but they would also drive the price down. So it is unlikely that private companies will do this. And as new variants begin cropping up more often, the vaccination needs of every nation are changing.
Yeah, as poor nations struggle to get doses at all, there is a mounting need for boosters and seasonal vaccination. To ensure a safer globe, vaccine distribution must become more equitable as more types of doses develop.
Truer words haven't been spoken, right?
Yeah.
That is so incredibly important. And as we've done here on COVID Noise Filter, we will definitively continue to follow the COVAX story.
COVID echoes HIV. The Western world needs to start learning from past experiences with pandemics, including HIV, according to an NPR article.
Yes, indeed. People in low-income countries have suffered from inaccessibility to life-saving HIV drugs that were widely available in countries like the U.S., but not in Africa. And many activists call this a crime against humanity. But advocates in South Africa and Kenya began fighting patents that would prevent the creation of many more affordable generic drugs.
Something similar is actually happening with the COVID-19 pandemic. High-income countries can vaccinate huge portions of their populations because aid is brought to those in low-income countries. They are hoarding vaccines, and many countries don't seem to understand that if one is vulnerable, everyone is vulnerable. Low-income countries are paying higher prices.
Yes, indeed. Now, countries need to focus on fair distribution of vaccines for COVID, promote the creation of organizations like PEPFAR and the Global Fund, whose focus on financial and distribution development of medicines, not allow companies to monopolize on life-saving medicines, and expand the creation of affordable and generic medications.
Advocates for HIV and AIDS from decades ago are now doing the same thing for COVID-19. We have the knowledge and resources to make these changes and ensure equitable access to quality healthcare.
Again, truer words have not been spoken. Julia, thank you so much for bringing a story like this to the forefront. It is so incredibly important.
Yes.
Grief support through religion and spirituality in the pandemic. Now, the pandemic has brought forward painful heartbreaks and grief as people continue to lose loved ones to COVID-19. Now, under normal circumstances, many people turn to faith leaders to find solace and healing during the grieving of a loss. Now, with COVID-19, this process has been halted as community gatherings are still not permissible.
Funeral proceedings, among other events which help people navigate through grief, have been limited due to the continued threat of coronavirus. Given these challenges, faith leaders across different religions and spiritual beliefs have adapted to provide support through faith in new ways.
That's right. In fact, Pastor Patrick Young hosts a congregation of 350 people in New York. The congregation has not come together in person for over a year. But during the pandemic, several members of the church did pass away from COVID. On the other hand, most of his congregation knew someone who who passed away from COVID. And as the numbers grew, Pastor Young decided to start a fireside chat weekly on Thursdays, in which he does a phone call with the entire congregation.
During these calls, he includes a segment called Faith Through the Pandemic to allow his congregation to grieve, vent, or simply talk out the collective emotions and feelings they are experiencing. Though they cannot congregate in person, he offers these phone calls as a means to continue community support through their shared faith.
In Los Angeles, Rabbi Jason Weiner is a chaplain at a hospital. He explains that hospital chaplains have a particularly challenging job as they're constantly surrounded by death within the hospital. Huh, imagine that. A chaplain has a difficult job because they're surrounded by death in the hospital. That's something that Julie and I can talk about all day long.
Oh, yeah.
Many families who lose loved ones display an array of emotions that grief brings on. Sometimes the family members feel anger or distrust with God or frustration with the unwanted circumstances before them.
Rabbi Weiner explains that his role is to help ground these families in these moments of grief. He offers his compassion and love and tries to help soothe the tension experienced after a loss of a loved one.
So we're collectively experiencing grief across the globe right now, and many are not able to fully go through the process of grief as COVID-19 continues to produce more grief before we can heal from prior losses. Faith leaders and representatives have been challenged to discover ways in which they can still offer spiritual support under new restrictions that the pandemic has brought.
Many have adapted to institute new facets of supportive systems within faith-based communities. The underlying message is that no one is in this alone. Faith leaders want to remind people that their emotions are valid and there is space to work through their grief process and begin to heal, even if the space is virtual for the time being.
Indeed. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KABU. Consider adding KABU to your will, or add KABU as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KABU along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful